The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for April 12th, 2018, the Farewell, My Blue-Eyed Monster edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. John Dickerson of CBS This Morning is in New York City. Hello, John.
Hello and good morning.
And in New Haven is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Howdy, Emily.
Hello to both of you.
I can see Emily. I cannot see you, John, on GChat. And Emily looks about 58 feet tall because of the camera angle. It's actually quite daunting. You can intimidate the hell out of me, Emily, even more than usual this week.
I'm like making myself throwing my arms out to make myself as scary as possible.
I think I'm going to stand up and just make bear noises. Ah! Okay. On this week's Gabfest... The raid on the office of Michael Cohen, the president's lawyer and fixer. Will it prompt the president to fire special counsel Mueller or somebody else? Or will it throw the nation into chaos more than it already is?
I like the second tacked on part. I'll just throw the word chaos out there because it must apply.
It does. It does. It's all chaos.
How would we even know anymore when we're in chaos?
I was
afresh, as opposed to the chaos in which we're plopped down in.
I was at a conference this weekend with a bunch of journalists, and someone, I think, from the Washington Post said that he was starting to look up almost every day synonyms in the thesaurus for chaos and turmoil because he was tired of reading them in
the
his
word
own stories.
Chaos. Then Paul Ryan is leaving Congress. Is the House Speaker quitting, or is he dropping the mic? Because he's been so successful. Then Mark Zuckerberg, 14, Congress 0. The Facebook boss comes to Washington and, in my view, successfully bamboozles the politicians. Will it still lead to regulation of Facebook, or is Facebook now totally off the hook? Or does Facebook want to be regulated? I don't know. Emily will tell us. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And a reminder, of course, that we're just 3 weeks out from our first show in St. Louis. We are going to be at the Sheldon Concert Hall on Wednesday, May 2nd in St. Louis. There's still tickets at slate.com/live. And we have a special guest joining us, Jason Kander, the Secretary of State, once upon a time Secretary of State of Missouri, the Senate candidate, the political activist, perhaps future presidential candidate. Jason Kander will be joining us, and it's going to be a really fun show. So get a ticket at slate.com/live. So in the ongoing telenovela of the Trump presidency and the special series telenovela of the Mueller investigation, this week's big twist was the sudden raid on the office and residence of Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, who is Donald Trump's Doberman, his bully, his would-be Roy Cohn. This search warrant was executed not by Mueller, but by the Southern District of New York prosecutors and FBI officials who had been referred by Mueller to this, but then acted on their own. Apparently, after Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein signed off on the search warrant, the Cohen raid has driven the president to a fury. He canceled a trip to South America, I mean, ostensibly to deal with Syria, but basically to deal with this. And it has prompted new reporting that he has considering firing Rosenstein and Mueller and doing who knows what else, doing other crazy things. So, Emily, let's start with you. Why is it a big deal to raid a personal lawyer's office? Why is it a big deal to raid any lawyer's office? Why is that an extraordinary act?
Well, most communications between lawyers and their clients are covered by attorney-client privilege, which we've had a lot of discussion of this week. I'm happy that the nation is learning that attorney-client privilege is not absolute. It has exceptions, and one of the exceptions is if you are a lawyer and you are helping your client commit a crime and the government has probable cause to think that's what's going on, they can get a search warrant and take your computer and your phone and go ransack. Apparently, the agents were very polite. They can look at your communications. There are also rules after they receive the communications that we've also been hearing about where then a taint team from within the prosecutor's office goes through, takes out things that should still be covered by the attorney-client privilege. It's all very delicate. It's all very unusual. It's a tactic we associate with ongoing criminal enterprises like the mob. One kind of question here to think about, too, too, it's not clear how much Michael Cohen really acts as a lawyer for Donald Trump or whether he's really like a fixer, consigliere kind of figure. He's actually compared himself to the Robert Hagen, or was it Tom Hagen, character in The Godfather? And if that's the case and the government doesn't think he's really fulfilling legal duties, maybe that also contributed to the willingness to search this office. But this is a big, weird deal. Doesn't mean it was the wrong thing for the government to do. I feel like we don't know enough yet because we're getting this kind of drip drip in learning about what they were actually looking for. And I don't think the pieces add up yet. I don't think we know fully yet what they're investigating.
You know, in my high school, we didn't have a taint team. It was always one of our greatest regrets.
Here's you know, if you had, St. Albans would have beaten you.
Yeah, that's probably
true.
That was
a little bit like
that was a little insider.
You're really having to return to your Washington, D.C. prep school competitions. Okay, boys.
Right. Now, well, I let the record state that it was not both sides. Don't practice false equivalence here.
True.
It was,
you're right. Only
it was David Plotz who went to St.
Albans
who, such a competitive nature, he had to assert it.
I was on the varsity. I was on the varsity. I was on the varsity taint team, John. You were probably only on the JV.
John,
he taint letting it go. Anyway, here's the thing about the lawyer, which this seems to really strike at the very heart of the president's personal challenges. What happens when you're a fixer? And by the way, do you have to take a special test to be a fixer? Like, when do you and what activity do you have to engage in to be a fixer? Usually it is you make problems go away, not in the courtroom. In fact, you keep them out of the courtroom, which means that by its very nature, being a fixer means you are sometimes engaging in areas that are gray. We have now seen from the public record that he is engaged with respect to the president's various dalliances as a private citizen. The area is quite gray indeed. It's not just paying off people to be quiet. It's bank shots where you have your friend at the National Enquirer buy a story in order to scotch the story. You create and destroy companies willy nilly in order to create shells through which you can pay things. This is a fellow, Cohen, who is engaging in a lot of kind of outside the normal boundaries behavior. And he also has the sort of air of the untucked shirt tail, which is to say, when Bob Mueller does something, whenever we see it, it is done with perfect punctuation. The grammar is airtight. It's belt and suspenders. And so over time, you get a sense that whatever he's doing, what you're not seeing is being done in the most methodical and meticulous way. Michael Cohen is kind of a separate kind of character where you get the sense that there's a lot of things written on napkins and possibly receipts with important information that are tucked under the cushions of the couch. And that if there was behavior going on outside of the normal boundaries of things, there might not have been all the necessary cleaning up afterwards that you would want if you were a client who needed a lot of stuff hidden. And then finally, in order to have this no-knock warrant at these three places with this kind of speed, it suggests to me, and Emily, tell me on a legal basis here if I'm totally wrong, but that this wasn't just a fishing expedition, or if it was a fishing expedition, it was the kind of fishing expedition that happens after you have two coolers full of fish and you go back to the jetty where you caught all those fish because you know there's going to be more fish to get. In other words, you had to have a lot of information that gave you the reason to go into these three different places and look for all of this stuff outside of the normal context of the Russia investigation.
And you have to convince a judge that you need to do all of that quickly without a subpoena, even though you have a witness slash subject slash whatever Michael Cohen is who claims to be cooperating.
Right.
Can I ask a kind of step back question about this, which is, it is clear Donald Trump is just a sleazy person, immoral, disgusting, you know, grotesque personal behavior, a narcissist, impulsive, an atrocious president. All of these things we can, I certainly am happy to put on the record. I don't know that I am super hugely comfortable with where this investigation is stretching. I want to know, as a citizen, I want to know the nature of Russian and other foreign interference in the election. I want to know whether the Trump or the Trump team, cooperated with a foreign government. I want to know whether Trump because of personal financial ties, is compromised by his Russia relationship and potentially being blackmailed. But the general sort of kind of campaign sleaziness and personal sleaziness of the Stormy Daniels, of the McDougal, of maybe this doorman, that of the kind of the bullying of people, the paying off of people to cover up his own personal peccadilloes and horrible behavior. I'm just not sure. I think I kind of agree with the people who say this doesn't belong in the same investigation.
Well, maybe.
But you don't have the evidence to know whether to make that claim or not.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
They have probable cause.
That's true. I don't.
And also, it's possible that Bob Mueller also, and I don't think we know this, but the fact that it was the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office that conducted the raid and seems to have this part of the investigation suggests that Bob Mueller is trying to keep some distance from this. You know, I mean, I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, David. On the other hand, if there is a pattern of hush money payments and connected who knows what, that were all in the run-up to the election and they were all undisclosed and they benefited the candidate and that was part of the intent, then that seems like those are campaign finance violations and it doesn't seem like tiddlywinks to me.
It sort of seems like tiddlywinks to me, or it sort of seems to me like more the election more or less litigated the question of, is Donald Trump an unethical, grotesque, immoral human being, that everyone kind of agreed to that. That was the deal that was made. It was like, yes, this dude is a sleazeball,
and we don't care who he paid off and how much money and his lawyer spent outside of the bounds of campaign finance.
No, I'm not saying that exactly. Because of course, at some point, you know, if you twist the election sufficiently and you're doing it enough, it becomes material and really important. I'm just saying that in comparison to what I perceive to be a genuine, like, huge threat to the nation and to our electoral process and to the integrity of the country, this part seems slightly trivial.
Well, it's tawdry, but I agree with John. We just don't know yet.
Yeah, and you're using people who think all of those things about the president are choosing this moment of the investigation of Michael Cohen to celebrate it as affirmation of all those things that they think about the president, but they are not Mueller. Mueller is doing it for other reasons. And just because they're celebrating it for that reason doesn't really tell us anything about why Mueller's doing it. And why Mueller's doing it presumably is what got him, you know, the judge to sign off on it and so forth and so on. If in the end of the day it turns out it's just what you say, then I would agree.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, like, we saw this happen. We saw a version of this, and I'm not at all comparing them. Well, I am obviously comparing them. But we saw a version of this with Bill Clinton, and I thought the investigation into the Bill Clinton's sins and then the crimes he committed to cover up those sins was a bad investigation at the time, even though his behavior was loathsome and appalling. And I if in fact the investigation is basically, these are Trump's sexual sins and here are the crimes he committed to prevent those sexual sins from being made known, I think I might feel the same way.
Well, we're more in John Edwards land, and there was actually a prosecution, not a conviction, but a prosecution in that case. I mean, I just feel like we have to reserve judgment. I keep thinking about how when I worry about overzealous prosecutors, what I worry about the most are situations that never, ever make the news. It's poor people in court, ordinary people who don't have the ability to pay anyone, much less, I mean, I guess holding out Michael Cohen is the kind of lawyer you would want to hire. Maybe that is a little weird, but they're not the president of the United States is the point. And the press isn't there scrutinizing every single move. So if there is like a spectrum of concern about overzealous prosecutors, this lands me on the other side, especially when you're in a situation where all these people are part of the Trump administration. I mean, Mueller is a little bit separate from it, but not – he doesn't have the independence that Ken Starr had. And Rod Rosenstein had a lot of reasons not to sign off on this search warrant, right? Every incentive. He knew that Trump was going to get incredibly angry and talk about firing him. And because the incentives all line up toward protecting the president in a situation like this, I feel like we need to give these guys the benefit of the doubt, at least until we have enough evidence to know that something is awry here.
All right. If you're a Slate Plus member, you get a bonus segment on the Gabfest and on other Slate podcasts. And our Slate Plus bonus segment today, we're going to talk about a proposal in Washington, D.C. to lower the voting age to 16. Is it a good idea to have 16-year-olds voting for president? Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member of Slate Plus. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. House Speaker Paul Ryan, he of the toned body and the deep blue eyes, announced that he will not seek re-election. It leaves his Wisconsin district with a top Republican candidate who is literally a white nationalist anti-Semite. But we can set that aside for the moment. Ryan's departure has long been rumored. John, why did he decide to leave now?
Well, I think we're still sort of unpacking all the reasons. And there are multiple reasons, and they can all stand at the same time. The reason he was talking about most forcefully in his interview with our own Gayle King on CBS This Morning, he doesn't want to be a weekend dad. He wants to be around his kids before they leave high school. I think it's also possible that the things that would keep you and let you stay, which would be working hand in glove with a wildly popular president who is committed to a very specific, limited agenda, if that existed, he might very well stay. The things that Ryan ultimately believes in, free trade, how to create unity in the country, and particularly across racial lines, and how to address poverty. None of that is on the president's agenda, which is why the president, when he ran for office, attacked Paul Ryan repeatedly. And then finally, he was able to get tax reform passed. One way to keep that in perspective is that as he was resigning, saying tax cuts that he passed, not reform, because there wasn't very much reform in the bill, the tax cuts that he passed, that was a signature achievement of his career. On the very same day that was happening, Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, who's also resigning, said that his vote in support of those same tax cuts was the worst vote of his career. That gap between the two of them on that very same day gives you a sense of how difficult the 2018 election is going to be. And I think that was the final piece. The Republicans are in really bad shape in the House. 53 some odd seats, according to the Cook Political Report, are up. Volatile president. It was going to be a bad year, and being a minority leader was not something that would be very fun, especially if you're not being around home except on the weekends.
So he had a job that was so unpleasant that he would rather spend his time around his teenage children. Like, that has to be a really, really unpleasant job. So, Emily, is the story of Paul Ryan a tragedy? Here's someone who, at least in his rhetoric, had grand ideas about uniting the country, about a reconciliation, about reforming taxes, about curbing entitlements, about changing the, you know, reducing the size of the federal government, about reforming immigration. And he did accomplish none of that. He was a, you know, practiced fiscal, he at least was a rhetorical believer in fiscal conservatism, but will preside over an enormous ballooning of the federal deficit. Is this a tragedy? Is this somebody who came to Washington with grand ideas and has essentially failed at every single one, but at a very high level of power?
I don't recognize the kind of main image I have of Paul Ryan in either of your descriptions. I also feel like we can't lay at his feet all of those failures as if that was like his individual defeat, because there were a lot of things stacked against him in getting even his fellow Republicans to go for his ideas. I just want to add in here that, you know, whatever rhetorical weight Ryan gave to unifying the country, he also stood by while this incredibly divisive president has said all kinds of racist and prejudiced things and alienated lots of groups. He did not take any kind of firm moral stand at a key moment. Now, maybe he was in an impossible position, but I don't want to forget about that. And also, some of his ideas about entitlement reform seem to be designed to take things away from middle-class people and especially low-income people in a quite harsh kind of Ayn Randian fashion. So, you know, the notion that he is some grand figure, I feel like, and other people have said this, that Ryan sort of got credit for trotting out wonky-looking budget sheets as if he was a real believer in limited government for its own sake. But there's always been this incredibly harsh side of his plans. And for that reason, I just feel like it's hard for me to weep at this moment.
I wasn't proposing weeping. I was just asking go ahead, John, you go ahead.
Well, I was just saying that what I think you've identified is two questions. One, which is a potential moral failure, which is to say that if he had these feelings going all the way back to the campaign, and there has been reporting that when he was told by Reince Priebus, this was in Politico, but there's also been other reporting that he was expecting Trump to lose and that he was going to give a speech about how the Republican Party had to resist and go in another direction than the Trump direction. And then when it turned out that Trump had won, that speech kind of got put into the drawer. That dark night of the soul, that's a moral question, right? So what did you have to put on the shelf in order to get tax cuts? And was that a big price relative to your own moral code, whether it's about race, gender, national unity, or whatever? That's the moral piece you were talking about by standing by. And so that's something he's got to come to terms with. And he also had to say, you know, he had to speak up on behalf of the president and stand by him. There were times he certainly called him out, whether it was on the Muslim ban or Charlottesville, but there were also other times where he witnessed on behalf of the president's good heart on the question of various things. So that's the moral side. The other is, isn't it possible to have, maybe in your view or other people's views, a wrongheaded approach, but one that is still motivated by the right intentions? It just chooses, you know, he has a view about the power of markets to help people who need the most help, and he chooses to do it a different way, which is an intellectual, possibly intellectual and ideological mistake in the way he thinks the world works. But that seems to me is different than these moral questions about, you know, what your duty is to stand up when somebody is doing something that is counter to what you know is counter to your beliefs.
I feel like Paul Ryan somehow gets a pass. It's as if we take him at his word that, you know, yes, he really has the well-being of poor people at heart because he says so, even though his policy prescriptions are utterly at odds with all the evidence about how you would actually help people. And I don't see why I should take him at his word when all of his donors want what donors of Republicans want, which is not to help poor people. That is, I don't believe that the kind of free market ideology that he claims has enough of empirical pillar at this point to be credible. And so the notion that he somehow stands apart from all of that, I find it risible. I mean, this is a person who's raised an enormous amount of money for the Republican Party, which just gave a huge tax cut to very, very wealthy people at the expense of almost everyone else in a way that is, you know, creating mountains and mountains of debt, as we were just discussing. So I honestly just don't get it. It's like because he has those blue eyes and those charts, he gets a pass.
So anybody who's spent as much time talking to addicts and talking to people that are poor across the country as he has seems to me to, if the question here is you're questioning purely his heart, then I think that, you know, anybody who spent as much time as he has with them isn't doing it because it, you know, gives him six-pack abs.
Well, I think Emily's right that at some point if the lived experience of the world is so at odds with what your heart is telling you, then you're doing a wrong towards the world.
He obviously doesn't think it's at all.
Right. No, he doesn't think it, but
he just thinks it's never been implemented, and what a shame that it hasn't been, because then people would be helped. He may be totally wrong in that, but it seems to me that doesn't wrongness, if we were all judged by our heart by the times we were wrong, we'd all be screwed.
I also think that actually there are three main pillars of Ryanism. One is what you're talking about, Emily, which is these attacks on entitlement programs and changing the way the federal government works in ways that I agree would be devastating. But a second pillar is a tax reform as opposed to tax cuts, to changing the structure of the tax system to make it simpler and fairer. And the third is a relative tolerance on immigration. I mean, that's not a pillar, but something he definitely believes. And on those second and third ones, he totally lost. He like he was on the side that I think is the side of the angels, and he just failed completely.
And then when he lost, he didn't turn on the people who had caused his defeat. He didn't do anything to show that his heart, as you say, John, was in that place in a way that was actually going to cost him anything or go beyond the sort of political situation he was in. He took a different deal. He decided to become the majority leader and, you know, essentially be one of Trump's henchmen for the most part. And that record to me stands for more than the kind of notional ideas about what he would have preferred.
Emily, I think you're totally – that is a completely fair point. I'm not going to – I think that's a really fair – devastating attack on him. I would say, as somebody who is I'm an institutional person and somebody who believes in the power of institutions and believes in working within institutions and trying to build within an institution, I think Ryan made a bet that he could build within the institution of the Republican Party and the Republicans in Congress, and he could use that to slowly by slowly, as my mother-in-law would say, accomplish the kinds of things that he wanted to accomplish. And the tragedy, when I think of the tragedy of Paul Ryan, is that he made a bet on an institution and he totally failed. He was unable to change the institution. The institution was too chaotic. He faced a president who was too awful and too unreliable, and a caucus of Republicans who are so uncompromising. So the tragedy is that the institutions have failed. He's somebody in another era would have been a totally capable, reasonable, deal-making House leader, and he just couldn't do it in this era. And that's And probably nobody can ever do it.
He'll be back. That's my prediction.
Last word on this to whichever one of you wants to take it. It looks like the next Republican leader, who probably will not be the House Speaker, or maybe I suppose could be the House Speaker, will be Kevin McCarthy, who's the current majority leader, possibly Steve Scalise, who is the much more conservative House Republican whip, who has a lot of... won a lot of sympathy and goodwill from his fellow members of Congress after he was wounded in the congressional baseball game shooting and has made such a great recovery from it. In either case, it's going to be a more conservative person than Ryan is. Do you either of you see this either of them being able to bring that House Republican caucus to heal better, to govern more effectively than Ryan has been able to?
No. The challenge is that the speaker is not as powerful as the speaker used to be.
Bingo.
For a variety of reasons. Death of earmarks, rise of the base, improvisational unpredictability of the president. So it chewed up John Boehner. It's chewed up Ryan. It chewed up Gingrich. So... no, I think it'll be a rough road for that next speaker as well.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Facebook monarch Mark Zuckerberg deigned to appear on Capitol Hill this week. He spent two afternoons answering questions from senators and House members. And they didn't really lay a glove on him. The House did somewhat better on Wednesday than the Senate did on Tuesday. But Zuckerberg apologized effectively for various data breaches. He ducked ably, made various promises to supply answers in the future, claiming he didn't have the necessary information at hand. And it seems clear that despite the general bipartisan sense that Facebook has been very, very naughty and is quite powerful, that it's unlikely to bear any huge consequence from this. That's my read on it. But Emily, you are a much deeper thinker about Facebook than I am. What's your read on how this 2 days of hearings went for Zuckerberg and for Facebook and for the country?
Well, I thought the second day was more effective in terms of, I mean, I think everything you said was true, but when you listen to some of the tape, it's pretty unsatisfying if you're looking for answers. And I was struck by how the tough questions were coming from both sides of the aisle. You know, it's a big quandary. It's as if we've all, or many people, certainly Congress, has kind of woken up to this, like, giant blow up elephant that does like 8 million things. And one of the representatives very effectively took Zuckerberg through the various functions, like, you enable people to send money to each other. So are you a banking company? Are you a media company? And, you know, Zuckerberg retreats to this idea that Facebook is a technology company, but we all know that it has these very different functions. And then the representatives in the House were also grappling with this question of monopoly. You know, what seemed to me to emerge was quite clear that Facebook is not complying with this 2011 consent decree from the FTC. The FTC is looking like seriously defanged in all of this in a way that is not so good. And then there are questions, obviously, still about political ads, whether Congress could at least address, you know, political advertising and making sure that we know who is paying for it online. Now Facebook has changed its position and is in favor at least of that piece of legislation. But there is this big regulatory challenge here. And I felt like on the second day we were starting to see members of Congress really grapple with that. And a lot of ideas are percolating around. So I'm not ready to give up on the idea that they could figure out how to regulate. And I think even regulate effectively.
I was unclear what the Mark Zuckerberg was there to talk about. I don't understand.
What the regulations are. What was the point?
Oh, I was hoping one of you was going to answer that.
No, I hate these rituals. I mean, Zeynep Tufekci, and I'm probably pronouncing her name wrong, who's an academic, wrote a piece saying that she thought that the questions, that they shouldn't ask any questions, that the whole ritual is useless, and that what we need to move on from is expecting Zuckerberg's apologies to mean anything, to holding him accountable. And she put some ideas forward about, you know, making sure that people are opting in a very clear way, to having their data shared, to have a kind of sunset so that when you agree to have your data shared, it's not out there forever. Various other ideas related to the kind of the privacy part of the problem, which I think is only like a piece of the problem with Facebook right now.
What are the other pieces?
Well, I mean, other people have been asking whether we need to just ban target advertising, right? So, you know, what does Facebook sell? It's not selling our data. It's selling what it knows about us based on what it can glean from our data and the algorithms, the usefulness that comes from that. Is it realistic to ban all target advertising? That seems like sort of taking us back into the past. But I don't know. Maybe that's not so crazy. And I continue to be really interested in the whole problem of hate speech. Zuckerberg said at one point that they've invested a lot in AI as a way of trying to deal with hate speech, but they're 5 or 10 years away from being able to address it effectively. That made me go back to my reporting for my book on bullying in like 2010, when I was asking them about AI-related efforts at MIT that some folks there thought were really promising, and they were totally dismissing the whole idea of being able to deal with this. Well, you know, now Facebook has had to hire 20,000 people to try to police the site. So I think they're taking more seriously the notion that they have to figure out, or at least maybe there's some pressure to have them actually, like, engage with these issues.
They don't know what hate speech is. John, sorry, you were interrupted a minute ago.
What I wonder is whether you could have, and this is the kind of suggestion that the olds make that the youngs snicker at. But so there are ingredients on boxes of cereal that tell you everything that's in it. It would be great if a site and or apps had a uniform, very short description of all of your information that was being used, that was easy to get to, that was like the ingredients label, which is, you know, in the same place on every box of everything, where you knew precisely everything of yours that was being used either for the app itself or the website itself, and or depending on what other laws are passed, and or being used to and being sold to third parties. So that anytime you wanted to, it would be very easy to go check.
That's not at all a stupid idea, John.
I know. I like that idea, too.
We're all old. Can I actually express a different opinion or ask you guys to correct me? I don't really use Facebook very much, and God, I do not understand it. I tried to find out where the information about whether I had been compromised to Cambridge Analytica was. I couldn't even find it on my Facebook page.
You're not alone.
So there's that. But is there something wrong with me that I am not bothered by the harvesting and sharing of my information and my browsing habits and the data about me? I want to be able to be hit with targeted advertising. I'd much rather be hit with targeted advertising than untargeted advertising. As a person who runs a small business, the ability to use the targeted marketing of Facebook and other platforms is incredibly valuable. It allows small players to compete without huge budgets because you can reach people more specifically.
Yeah, and it also allowed, you know, Russian bots to plan all kinds of fake stories about Hillary Clinton and sex rings to the people who are subsessed. That's the problem, right? I also don't have some personal feeling that the harvesting of my data is, like, even particularly interesting, much less, like, nefarious toward me. But that's because I think this is true for you. Like, you think about your, you know, lovely Atlas Obscura business. You're trying to make people's lives more joyful and full of discovery. You're not trying to manipulate them into sharing fake news or, like, you know, bringing a gun into a pizza place because they heard some crazy rumor.
Okay,
I don't think we can separate these things.
Well, I think the kinds of data sharing that I really worry about, I do worry about, you know, health insurers getting access to certain kinds of data about people and using that to make decisions to deny coverage or limit their coverage or reveal private information to employers that compromise people's lives. That worries me. Like and probably Facebook bleeds into that, but that seems to me a separate thing. The ability to sort of target groups of people with information that may be manipulative is, like, mildly troublesome, and clearly, you know, it's not always the best thing. But I think of that as advertising. I think of that as, like, a useful function in the world. And yes, the example of Russian bots manipulating people is bad, but that's not the only thing that is happening with targeted advertising.
I feel like we don't understand yet, right? Because regular advertising is something we've all become essentially numb to. We're used to ignoring it. It hasn't destroyed, you know, society as we know it. And maybe that will prove to be true of targeted advertising as well. But right now at this moment, it feels like it's having a different kind
of... Facebook targeted advertising is not destroying the country. Facebook targeted advertising was one piece in a, like, an extremely divisive election, which helped Donald Trump get elected. But Facebook target advertising is not the reason Donald Trump is president. You know, it's not the full stop reason. It's one small piece of a huge set of other issues, most of which have to do with the fact that we are an extremely divided nation.
Right. But I mean, it's not just the United States, right? Mm-hmm. There also are other elections and other questions about the rise of right-wing parties and authoritarianism in other parts of the world that also seem influenced by the way in which people are using social media. And there is a chance that social media, which was supposed to connect us and unify us, right? I mean, how many times did Zuckerberg say that to Congress, is actually a force for division in a way that builds on exactly the trends that do concern you. I think we know the answers to that. I just feel more aware of being concerned and trying to think it all through.
I want somebody to speak up for and be consistent and repetitive about the responsibility that users have to not be fooled into believing that there is a basement in a restaurant that has no basement in which there's pedophilia going on. I want people to be I want somebody to shame all of us for the behavior that allows us to be so easily emotionally fooled. That I want that. A, B. I want smart people, lawyers, and or maybe members of the press to improve congressional hearings like this. Like, it doesn't seem to me that it would be that hard to do, which is to say, here are the key questions at issue about the past. So A, why is the user agreement so bad at Facebook? B, is your business model inherently at tension with all of your apologies? The key here is you're trying to build a product that gets people addicted. And every time you do that, you're going to be open to messing with people and open to people creating apps on your platform that do bad things with that emotional connection and attention. Then there are a set of questions about possible legislation. I want somebody to not speak in these, like, absurd generalities, like, would regulation be good or bad? And then let's have somebody else weigh in about whether regulation – well, that's like saying, would food be good or bad?
Yeah.
You know, you have to get a little bit more specific before it's illuminating to anybody. Why couldn't that all be taken care of beforehand so that this would actually be useful. The answer, of course, is that everybody wants their moment. And the moment is not necessarily about illuminating the thing, but the moment is about asking your ponderous question in a way that's theatrically good so that it gets picked up on television.
I totally agree, John. Totally agree.
I remind myself with the gentleman in New York.
Why don't they? There are sometimes hearings where there's the counsel asks the questions.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's like investigative hearings, right?
Yeah. But I don't know why that can't be in your run-of-the-mill hearing. It would be much better if one person or, you know, one person for each party is sort of designated. Okay, here's the questions. I'm going to follow up. I'm going to not let them jump away. I'm not going to let the time expire because they only have 5 minutes to ask a question. I mean, there were 44 senators who got to ask questions.
Yeah,
I don't know if they all did. That's
format.
Insane.
You know, another thing, can we do this? Can we add, what would be nice is that because we have technological know-how now, you could put hashtags on articles and blog posts and whatever else that would allow you to, let's say it's 3 weeks before the hearing, anybody who wants to weigh in on this question tags whatever they write or think about, and then everybody does their independent thinking, and then somebody just has the job of curating it in a useful way that produces this, you know, short, targeted piece of intelligence that could be used to make our lives better.
John Dickerson has the nutritional information for websites. He's solved congressional hearings. He's hashtag things. It's awesome.
Here's just what happens when you get up at 4 a.m.
This is the best morning ever. This is going to be like the year that Einstein thought up special relativity and whatever else he thought up. People are going to look back on this podcast segment and the world will have changed.
I hope that as Mark Zuckerberg flies back to California, Congress recognizes that there is bipartisan support for effective regulation and put some real muscle into figuring this out and passes something rather than frittering away this opportunity, as I fear it will.
Fritter, fritter.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Let us go to cocktail chatter when you are frittering, making apple fritters, and having a hot toddy to go with your apple fritters. No, it's spring. You're probably having a julep or something. I don't know. You don't have apple fritters in the spring anyway. You're having pea shoots. You're having a cocktail made of pea tendrils, Emily. What will you be chattering about?
A judge in California on the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit named Stephen Reinhardt died last week. He was a judge I was extremely fond of personally. He was also just an amazing figure. There was really no one left on the bench like him. He was a liberal lion, in the words of, I think, the New York Times obituary. You know, even though he was 87, it felt to a lot of people who knew him like this incredibly unexpected, super sad loss. I was a little bit heartened this week because his last opinion was published, and it was about the holding in this opinion was that employers cannot merely cite past wages, prior salary, as their reason for paying women less than men. And so this last opinion from Judge Reinhardt begins with the sentences, "The Equal Pay Act stands for a principle as simple as it is just. Men and women should receive equal pay for equal work, regardless of sex. The question before us is also simple. Can an employer justify a wage differential between male and female employees by relying on prior salary? Based on text, history, and purpose of the Equal Pay Act, the answer is clear, no." It's just a great swan song from this amazing judge who so many people, including me, will miss.
John, what is your pea tendril cocktail chatter?
This is a post on the great website XKCD, and it's a newspaper article that reads, "The public events of the last 3 months are of the class which will go into its permanent history. We have been living in an atmosphere of history which will be immortally preserved. How accurately will future generations know the immense volume of grief and sorrow which has rolled over the land? Will those who come after us ever be able to understand the extent of our loss? Perhaps a careful reading of the daily papers of the present period may give some future antiquarian a fine idea of the feelings of the nation during the past summer, but these journals are so large, so full of detail, that we imagine the coming American will never find time to read the record. He must depend on a brief statement meagerly compiled by some dry and tedious historian. So that's from 1881. It struck me because, A, in 1881, they felt like things were happening too big and too fast and could never be. This is about around the time that Garfield, we're always returning to Garfield. Garfield is assassinated. And obviously the Civil War has happened not too in the distant future, but the way in which they felt like history was moving too fast could never be captured in one. And I wonder if that is true of today. Certainly everybody feels like history is blind. We are living in history in a way that we didn't during other eras that we've been alive for. And that it's moving by in such a vast, fast rate. And we can't even remember all the things that have happened. And even when you look at all the people who have been fired or forced to resign from the White House and the sheer tonnage of bodies, it just kind of feels like the pace is hard to, that we are in the new pace anyway. But I wonder then, no, maybe that's not the case. Maybe in 15 years, this will actually all be quite simple. And whatever the outcome is, will sort of be like, well, you know, A led to B and that led to C, and it will be relatively straightforward what happened. So I don't know. Anyway, that's what I was thinking about.
That's dark. That was dark, man. That was unexpectedly dark for Dickersonian chatter. I thought you were, when you go to Garfield, it's usually, even when they're digging around for the bullet in Garfield's body,
it's usually for laughs.
Jolly.
Kicks.
Oh, well. All right, my chatter. First of all, before I get to my chatter, I want to shout out another Slate podcast live show. The wonderful Slow Burn podcast is doing a live show in New York on April 19th. Leon Neyfakh will talk to Bob Woodward and Gail Sheehy and Virginia Heffernan. And that would be so awesome. The Slow Burn podcast is an absolutely brilliant podcast about Watergate. And the live show format will be delightful for it. So go to slate.com/live to get tickets to that April 19th show in New York. My chatter is about a series I've been watching on Netflix with my dear wife, Hannah, called Wild, Wild Country. You've probably heard of it. I don't know if either of you have started to watch this.
Not yet. Should we?
You should.
No, I'm still cleaning up on Stranger Things.
It's absolutely fantastic. It's a 6-part documentary series about the Rajneesh, this spiritual leader and his followers who took over a region of Oregon in the early 1980s.
Oh, I know about this. Sorry. I'm going to explain why, but I'll let you speak first.
And there's an incredible footage. Most of the key players are still alive and still talking. There's amazing contemporaneous documents from it that paint the history. And it's just, the story is absolutely bananas. We're only about halfway through. It's brilliantly edited and also fun and weird. So Wild, Wild Country on Netflix.
So is this the group that took over this part of Oregon and, like, well, maybe you're not done yet, but it completely took over the local government?
Yes.
Okay. So it is because
of that. Don't give anything away, but go ahead.
It is because of that group and the concern that it caused in then Senator Hatfield that we have a provision in the National Voter Registration Act that tells states to purge people from the rolls. The whole idea of, like, cleaning up voter registration and protecting the voter rolls from marauding foreigners essentially comes from that story and Senator Hatfield's reaction to it.
That's really interesting. Maybe we'll get to that. The series is very exhaustive. Anyway, I really recommend it. It's got everything. Drama, compelling characters, weirdness galore. The Gapfest.
I can either be the person that I am or the person that people recommend me to be. I need an entire lifetime to do all the other things that have been recommended by you two.
I was trying to decide on which I would prefer, like the recommended version of you. But you just mean consumption-wise, not actually.
Yeah,
yourself.
Consumption-wise. I can't keep up with all the amazing things that you have recommended. I have them, most of them when they're books, I have them sent to Washington. And when I return home on the weekend, there's this Karen, like that you see on a hiking trail of all the books that you guys have read that I should be reading.
One day it'll just like topple over in a slight
topple
breeze,
over.
Sadly.
John and his life of quiet desperation felled by the books and now 6-part series.
that is our GabFest for today. The show is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is the magnificent Izzy Rode. Follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest or look to us on Facebook at facebook.com/GabFest. Please come to our live show in St. Louis on May 2nd, slate.com/live for tickets to that show. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.